Hi, this is Jill Jack, and you are listening to WHFR Dearborn, independent radio, broadcasting since 1985.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone, where local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you are listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And our guest today is Mr. Grant Cameron. Grant had his own personal UFO sighting in 1975 in Carmen, Manitoba, along with hundreds of other people. And during a prolonged flap, the object became known locally as Charlie Red Star. He began his own investigation and interviewed hundreds of witnesses. In the past few years, Cameron has turned his research interests to the involvement of and actions of U.S. presidents concerning the UFO problem. Many of these findings can be found at his website, which is presidentialufo.com. Mr. Cameron is working on a paper detailing the 64 reasons the government is covering up the ET presence. He is also now researching and lecturing on the connection of consciousness to the UFO phenomena, hoping that it will help explain how UFOs are propelled and what the real nature of the universe is. He has been interviewed on numerous media shows and has lectured all over the world. Let us now welcome Mr. Grant Cameron. Welcome to the show, Grant.
Well, thanks for having me on, Dave. I appreciate your interest in what I'm doing.
Always very interested. I saw your site. I became interested in your site, maybe 3 years ago. And wanted to get you on the show. One thing led to another, and finally it led to you, so I'm glad to, I was able to capture you, so to speak.
Let's do it then.
Able to abduct you, so to speak. Tell the listeners about this Charlie Red Star. What's that all about?
Well, this is, I have a manuscript that's about to be published on this. It was originally written back in the 1970s, and the local publisher who should have published it said to me, "Mr. Cameron, you may believe in this kind of stuff. Count me among the unbelievers." That was my rejection letter. And at that point, I just said, sightings is a waste of time. This is just nonsense, because I spent a long time running around interviewing people and getting the whole story. And what it basically came down to is, in 1975, there was a huge flap of sightings that occurred all across Canada and the United States along the border. A lot of the missile silos were infiltrated. Malmstrom Air Force Base had sightings. Grand Forks, Minot, Wurtsmith in Michigan, Loring Air Force Base, all along the border there was all these sightings. And I lived about 25 miles from the Minuteman III missile silos at the Grand Forks station, and my impression was that the Vietnam War had just ended, and I think there was some sort of thinking about using the missiles. There was an alert on with the missiles, and for that reason, all along the Canadian-U.S. border, these sightings took place, and I happened to get involved with it, just had really no interest in UFOs. I just, it was written up in the paper here quite a bit. There was a local TV crew had actually captured this thing jumping off the ground, and I just told my friends, I said, let's go and see what everybody's looking at, and strangely enough, we got lucky the first night, and I just sort of fell off the end of the earth, and I just sort of started chasing this thing. I thought it was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen in my life, and it started from there, and it's been going now almost 40 years.
Okay, so jumping off the ground, what does that mean?
Well, what happened was they had a bunch of local TV crews, because this thing was pretty regular. It was showing up, maybe not every night, but it was showing up quite a bit. And so what happened was you would have the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation was there with their TV crew, and the CTV network from the local affiliate here was out there. And they had the CTV crew from Winnipeg, the main big city where I lived, which is maybe 35 miles from the site, had been there, I think, a night before, two nights before, and they had seen this thing but weren't able to capture it. It was flying around. They weren't able to get a very good film. And so they went out the night when they actually filmed this thing, and there was actually, the thing was on the ground, and they had a three different crews. They had the TV guys stayed on the road. They had one, and these involved, I think there was four pilots were involved in this thing. They had some of the people went north of the object and across. Some people went south and across, and this thing was sort of in the west. And what happened was, so you had three different vantage points, these people trying to get close to this thing. The crew on the north side happened to come around a bluff of trees, and the thing was, as they described it, sitting like a movie screen, a 50-foot-high movie screen, blood red, wasn't touching the ground, but was on an angle like a movie screen, sort of hovering on the ground. And at that point, they took around, they looked around to look at the landscape, because you're out in the middle of nowhere here. There's sort of town here, a town way over there. And so they were looking at the microwave towers and stuff to get their perspective of where they were on in the, because it's pitch of darkness. And as they did that, they looked back and this thing was gone. And what had happened was they had sort of scared this thing. And the thing jumped up into the air, and the TV crew guy who was 8 miles away in the east was basically looking at his TV, and he wasn't even a TV. He was the first time he'd ever used a big TV camera from a studio, because the news broadcaster had said, this is nonsense, we're not paying any more overtime to chase this stupid thing. If you guys want to go, you can go out on your own. So this crew went out on their own. They were just determined to get this thing on film. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the guy is 8 miles away, and as these guys come near this object in the west, the thing jumps up in the air, and the guy in the filming the camera looks and he sees the thing flare up on the camera, go down, flare up, and he says, the next time it flares up, I'm going to shoot. As he shoots, as this thing flares up, the thing jumps up into the sky. And this thing was actually covered by NBC News. It was on a number of documentaries in the United States. CTV ran it a number of times, and basically what happened was this thing jumped, according to the calculations, had jumped 3 frames in the film, shooting 24 frames a second. It jumped 3 frames from the bottom of the frame to the top of the frame, and the object was 8 miles away. The calculations were that it had jumped 5,000 feet in 3 frames of film. Gee. So this guy gets this thing as it jumps into the air, and then he follows it across the sky. And what happens is when they process the film, whenever the camera is stationary, it picks up the object. Whenever the camera is moving, it doesn't pick up the object. So he picks it up as it jumps into the sky. Then he pans the camera into the north, following this object slowly flying along. And when he gets to the north, he figures he needs a frame of reference with stars and stuff like that. So he stops the camera, and this object flies through the frame of the film. And so when the thing is processed, there's 2 6-inch pieces of film, one where the thing jumps up into the sky and the second one where he gets it in the north. So that's basically this story about that got me involved. This was May of 1975, and when this thing was broadcast on the local TV station, we used to drive around the city here, and I said to my friends, instead of driving around the city, why don't we go out and see what he's looking at? This looks pretty interesting, because it was a pretty big story when this thing was captured jumping off the ground. So we went out there, and the first night, we were there for an hour, drove into town, out of town, into town, out of town, and it was, to me, it was like a total waste of time. It was like you buy the lottery ticket, you know there's a chance you're going to win, but you know you're not going to win, and that's the way it was. I figured, like, everybody else can see it. When we go out there, we're not going. Nothing's going to happen,
right.
And nothing did happen. We're driving into the town the very last time. My friend said, "We'll drive into Carmen one more time. If we don't see anything, we'll go home." I said, "That's fine with me. It's a total waste of time." And we were driving into the town the last time. The thing appeared from the left, going to the right, very, very low, down near the road, coming directly in front of the road, and just changed my life. It was just it was fairly close. It was not a light in the sky. This was an object. It was very intensely red, sort of pulsing, glowing type thing. But it was fairly close to us, maybe half a mile, three-quarters of a mile down the road from us, and moving very, very slow. And it started 40 years of chasing UFOs for me.
What was the shape of this object?
Well, you really couldn't see the shape because it was at night and it had this plasma or this corona around it. It was very, very bright. You could tell that it was longer than it was high. People described it as being, some people, 30 to 50 feet across. Possible. It's hard to tell at night because you're in pitch darkness, so it's either very close and very small or very far away and very big. So I would say 30 feet, but it was longer than it was high. And it looked like it was alive. It had this weird, it was unlike any light I've ever seen before. My father was a pilot. My son's a pilot. I've never seen a light like that. It was just very bizarre. And I always tell people, it comes down to this idea about believing, disbelieving, and knowing. If you have not seen a UFO, you can either do one of two things. You can either believe or disbelieve. If you see it, you know. And that's what happened to us. We were looking at... when we were driving in and out of the town, we were looking to see, you know, what is everybody looking at? We saw planets setting and stars and stuff, and we said, well, you know, is that it? And we couldn't figure out what everybody was looking at, and there was some things that looked kind of weird, but we said, oh, well, you know, if that's what it is, it's not very impressive. But the second that we saw it, nobody in the car said, is that what it is? Mm-hmm. Everybody instantly said, there it is. Instantly knew, because it was a very, very bizarre object, glowing, pulsing like it was alive. Everybody instantly said, there it is.
Wow.
We knew that's what everybody was talking about. And so it absolutely changed my life.
And how long did this flap go on with this Charlie Red Star object?
It started in February of 1975. That was sort of the first recorded. It went very, very heavy in Carmen and right down to the border where the Minuteman III missile silos were. That went on till, say, winter, because it's very cold here in the winter. You wouldn't get that many sightings in winter. Through 1976, the object was sort of still around, and it moved about, the flap seemed to move about 8 miles east to a town called Sperling. And I continued to watch the big objects, and then these small objects started to appear on the ground. That was mid-1976. And I used to take crews of people out there who wanted to film these small objects that were sitting on the roads. And so I would take out people, we'd shoot infrared film, we'd do all sorts of stuff, movie, film. And in the end, I just did, late 1976, I just figured, like, people were trying to surround this thing, we were trying to do all sorts of things to try to get close to this thing. I got close one time, the first time I saw this small object on the ground, I got close. After that, we really couldn't get close, and so I would tell people, okay, here's a map, you can go out and look for yourself, I'm not going out anymore, there's nothing more I can determine by standing there and watching this object and flashing lights at it and getting it to flash back and stuff. So I just sort of gave up, and I started to basically spend my time talking to people who had seen the object, cataloging it. And then when we got the rejection on the manuscript, I went on to investigate what the Canadian government knew. There was one of the witnesses there who had actually worked for the Canadian government in the early 1950s when they had set up a flying saucer observatory and this sort of stuff, and I started chasing what the Canadian government knew, because I sort of figured I knew what I saw, and what I saw was, as far as I was concerned, was nothing of this earth. It was very, very unusual, and I figured if I knew what I knew and saw what I saw, somebody had to know the story of what I was seeing, and that's when I started to chase the government, and as high-level officials as I could to try to figure out who had the answer to explain what I saw in May of 1975.
Mm-hmm. Going to your website now, there's a document called the Eisenhower Memo. I'm sure you're familiar with that. Tell our listeners about that.
Eisenhower Memo. You're talking about the MJ-12 document?
Well, the one where Truman is handing the problem off to Eisenhower.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is the famous MJ-12 document, which was released in 1987 and immediately came under attack from all sorts of skeptics like Phil Klass and various other people. And so we immediately, when that document came out, and what it is it's a briefing for president-elect. What happens when a new president is elected, he gets a briefing from the former CIA director of the administration before, and they give him the intelligence briefing. They tell him, you know, what countries we've overthrown, you know, who we knocked off, all the special ops stuff. And they give him all the secret stuff. And this MJ-12 document is Truman's briefing notes to President Eisenhower that basically described to him the fact as that the UFOs are real, the Roswell crash, and all this sort of stuff. When the document first came out, we were dealing with a guy at Penn State University, and his name was Dr. Eric Walker. He was the former president at Penn State University, the big Ivy League engineering college. We knew that he knew what was going on. We were in contact with him at the time, and we made a contact with him about 2 weeks after that document was released, and he was asked about that document, and what he stated was, I've known of them for 40 years, and the document talks about MJ-12, which is the control group for the UFO situation that was established in 1947. Mm-hmm. Walker said, this interview took place in 1987, he said, I've known of them for 40 years. Leave it alone. There's nothing you can do about it. Go and study something else. So he basically confirmed right from the word go that MJ-12 was for real. Now, the document, I think, it turns out it's been altered. It's not the real document. It's a hoax document. But the material that's in it is true. And so what I say the government has done is they have allowed the people to know that there is a control group, that there's a live alien, that there's back engineering at Area 51. They've leaked a bunch of material to the public, and they have protected the classified material. But they wanted the MJ-12 idea out in 1987, and they released this document, which they can legitimately say is a forged document. So nobody can really track the group, the legitimacy of the document, but the idea of MJ-12, a control group that controls the UFO situation, it gets out, and people start to acclimatize themselves to the fact that UFOs are real, and it's all being carefully controlled by some group inside. I think it is inside the government.
So are you saying that the government is purposely leaking some of the information to us?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
That's my theory. That's my contention. And what they, I think, are doing is they're trying to acclimatize the people so that everybody's back in 1947. They want sort of the stories to come out so people aren't so shocked. One CIA guy said, and he used to run the UFO files, his name was Dr. Kit Green, he was quoted one time as saying, if you had the problem, what would you do if you were the government? Well, what you do is you put out a bunch of crazy stories. You say, you know, the aliens are eating your kids and all this kind of stuff. Mm. And then when the story breaks, everybody goes, what's the story? And it's just extraterrestrials visiting. And then the people, you know, they've heard all these wild stories. They say, well, you know, they're not eating our kids. Mm. No. I said, they're just visiting. They're just here. Mm. And then everybody goes, well, what's the big deal? So they're playing this thing so that people are sort of used to it. And they've given us the basic components of the story, what's called the core story, the core story of what's going on, but the classified material as to the mental phenomena aspects that are involved, as to the metal, as to how they are propelled, all that kind of stuff is military technology. It's military boys with their toys. If you can develop this technology, you rule the world. So that kind of stuff is highly classified. They maintain all that kind of stuff. That kind of stuff isn't leaked. But the basic story that we are being visited is, I believe, being leaked by the government, and I have now just started to put out material that I believe very strongly that the aliens are doing exactly the same thing. There is a disclosure pattern that shows exactly what the aliens are doing, that they're acclimatizing people to the fact that they're here as well.
All right. So the Independence Day scenarios and the War of the Worlds scenarios, that's all part of the game, in other words.
Yeah, it's something that's put out there. Hollywood, I think, is the driving force behind this, and that started back already in 1950 with some of the movies back in the 1950s, this idea that extraterrestrials are here, and the key part is that nobody can confirm any truth to any of this sort of stuff. So the stuff floats around, people sort of hear about it, and as the old people die off, the young people come in, and they are accustomed to it. It's something that they basically, even now, you would ask most young people, and they'd say, well, sure, we're not alone in the universe, what's the big deal? Mm. But I started back in 1975, and in 1975 it wasn't that way. A lot of people really thought this was way out there, this was crazy. And today, I think it's 48% of people in the United States believe that UFOs are for real, and that's three times the number of people that believe the random theory of evolution, the idea that there was a big bang and there's no God and everything just happened by accident. There's only like 12 to 17 or 18% of people believe that. 48% of people believe that UFOs are real. So we are making some headway. This is basically being bought by the people, and eventually it's going to be in a situation where you're going to be in the minority if you don't believe this.
Yeah, they are now, I think. I got to take just a moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves here in Dearborn, Michigan, 89.3 FM on your radio and WHFR.FM on your computer. I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone, and we're speaking with researcher, UFO researcher, Mr. Grant Cameron, webmaster for presidentialufo.com. Now, Ronald Reagan had a couple of sightings before becoming president, didn't he?
He had, and it's not on my website. I don't think I've updated that. He actually had more than a couple of sightings.
Really?
He had one, which he was talking to the Wall Street Journal. He was talking to a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, and he started telling the reporter the fact that he was in a plane in his when he was the governor of California. And he had seen this object, and he told the pilot to chase this object. And the Wall Street Journal guy said, Mr. President, are you saying that you actually saw a UFO? And at that point, Reagan started to back off and said, oh, it's just an idea, you know, and he backed off. So that was his one sighting. The other one is even more dramatic. This is a sighting that occurred, and I've known about this for a number of years. This is a sighting. He was governor of California. The governor residence was in Sacramento. He was coming down to a cocktail party in Los Angeles. Steve Allen was there. The comedian Lucille Ball, the comedian actress, was there, and Ronald Reagan and Nancy came in late. Ronald Reagan was very excited. He was talking about they had seen this object, and it was just an amazing thing. And if you look at Lucille Ball's biography, she actually talks about this in her biography, and she says, I always wondered if people would have voted for Reagan if they had known this story. Just recently, it has been confirmed. I went through somebody associated with Shirley MacLaine. Shirley MacLaine has now stated that Lucille Ball told her at the time that there was not just a sighting, that Ronald Reagan actually had an interaction, a telepathic interaction with an alien during that sighting. So that's coming through Shirley MacLaine, and it was apparently told by Lucille Ball.
Wow. And he has said, Reagan has said, I often think, and if, I think he, five times he has said, I've often thought how our petty differences would just disappear if there was a outside attack from other worlds.
And that was the Yeah, the alien invasion remark that he had, and I got lucky at the library. I actually got when he said it at the United Nations in 1987 at his United Nations speech, and it was actually pulled from the speech. And in the speech, there's actually the handwritten copy at the Reagan Library where Reagan is saying he called it his fantasy. He says, "Could I please have it put back in?" So they put this thing back in. Ronald Reagan was very much into this whole thing. One of the things that people may not know is the story that happened with E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Steven Spielberg, this is June of 1981, E.T. the Extraterrestrial is out. Steven Spielberg goes to the White House to screen this. There are 39 people in the room. We know who all the people are. There's two astronauts. There's the head of NASA, head of CIA. The British ambassador to the United States is there. Senator Day O'Connor from the Supreme Court is there. And at the end of the movie, there's two different stories. One was told by Steven Spielberg to a film producer in Los Angeles. And that part of the story was at the very end, near the end of the movie, Steven Spielberg is sitting beside Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan leans over and says, "You know, I bet you there aren't six people in this this whole room know how true this whole thing is." So I had that on my website for a number of years, and then Steven Spielberg was in an interview. This is going back about a year ago. Steven Spielberg was in an interview, and somebody asked him about this. What did Ronald Reagan actually say? And he said that he doesn't talk about what happened at the end of the movie, but he said at the end of the movie, Ronald Reagan stood up. He looked around the room like he was doing a head count. And he said, "Steven, I'd like to thank you for bringing E.T. the Extraterrestrial to the White House. We very much enjoyed the movie, and I just wanted to let you know that there are a number of people in this room that know everything on that screen is absolutely true." So a lot of people say, you know, when the president stands up and says UFOs are real, I'm going to believe it. The president has stood up and said UFOs are real.
Yeah.
Said it in 1981.
But do you think that even if the president were to go before the people and tell them this, that it's real, that they'd accept it?
Oh, I think if the president stood up, because that's one of the things I wrote this article about, the 64 reasons why they're not telling you the truth. Mm. And one of the reasons is that if the president were to stand up and say, you know, "I just want to let you know ETs are for real," the government would shut down. I mean, you would have literally every reporter in Washington, D.C. on the White House lawn, and the questions would start. And you would have all sorts of inundations of questions. That's why they have to do it like in a joke. The president can never verify the thing, because then it suddenly it becomes open to ask the president a question. And that's why I sort of think that they float the idea that the president isn't in charge, that there's a secret group that is running the UFO situation, and that protects the president. Nobody asks the president what's going on with UFOs. It's always this conspiracy thing that there's some secret government inside the government. Because if the president stands up, and I always said, like, within the first 10 questions, and there'll be questions going on for a month. I mean, basically everything will shut down, and everybody's going to suddenly realize they've been had, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and everybody's going to suddenly take it serious and start asking the president, "What do you mean, Mr. President?" And then they're going to ask him, "Mr. President, it's been rumored that 2% of people in the United States have been abducted by these aliens. That's 7 million people. Mr. President, you're constitutionally responsible for the protection of the American people. What are you doing to stop this?" And the president has no idea how to stop it.
No.
He has no idea, even in a large extent, what's going on. He's going to be asked about, "Mr. President, it's been rumored that 10,000 cattle have been mutilated by these extraterrestrials. Can you verify this?" And what you get is that you spill the milk, and the milk is out there, and you cannot control it. And what happens in government, are people who run government are very gutless, and they are not going to do anything that's going to put them in a situation where they lose control of things. You don't want to be in a situation where you stand the president up in front of the American people and he starts answering a bunch of questions that he doesn't have any answers to. It makes the president look stupid. The president is supposed to be the guy who's in charge. He knows everything. He's in control of the economy. He's in control of everything. He's the smart guy. And you don't want him standing up there going, well, I really don't have an answer. And because what's going to happen, and a lot of people have talked about this, is if you own Shell Oil and it's $100 a share, it's going to open in the morning at $10 a share and be heading for zero. And you're going to sell, and then all the people associated with Exxon and BP and everybody's going to start selling, and if the stock market starts to melt down, there's nothing you're going to do to stop it unless you can say that you've got it under control, and there's nothing they can say that's going to say that this thing's under control. That's why they don't, that to me, that's why they don't release it. It's basically this fear of losing control of the situation once they do verify this, because a lot of people are going to start asking questions, and you really lose control at that point.
Yeah, well, they never had control of the situation, and doubt very much if they ever will.
So, but people think they do.
No.
People think it's a joke. People think that the president is, you know, he may be making some dumb mistakes. But basically, in fact, Dr. Eric Walker, at one point, this was a guy who was very high-level guy. He has 14 honorary doctorate degrees, head of Penn State University, chairman of the board of the Institute for Defense Analysis, the top military think tank in the United States. And when we were talking to him, we were pressuring him for all sorts of questions and answers and stuff like that. And at one point he said, "What's the big deal? We haven't blown up the world yet." That's what it comes down to, is when you brief the president, you go into the president when it comes to the UFO situation, and you say, "Mr. President, we don't have all the answers. If you give us another 5 years, 10 years, the longer you delay this, Mr. President, the more answers we're going to have, the better we're going to be able to control the situation. We can drill another oil well in Alaska. It's not too bad. The unemployment is only 8%. It's not the end of the world. There's no reason to panic. The longer you delay this thing, the better off we're going to be," and that's what it comes down to.
But after 60 years or more, they're still in control of the ET situation.
I think, yeah, they're not in control, but I think they have a pretty good understanding of what's going on. I think the aliens are running the show, no doubt about that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Jimmy Carter also had a close encounter sighting and vowed he'd release the truth to the American people if he was elected president. So what happened there?
Well, it's the same as Lyndon Johnson was very interested in UFOs. He had made a couple of comments. He'd actually answered a letter, a UFO letter, which is very unusual to have a vice president or a president answer a letter. You had Ford, who was adamant, who absolutely said that we should have a congressional investigation and we should get people under subpoena and force them to talk. He was furious. He wanted this thing released because what happened was he was involved in the 64 sightings in Michigan, and J. Allen Hynek was in his congressional district, and he was under a lot of pressure after they said this was swamp gas, and he thought this was absolute nonsense, and he was adamant that he was going to get to the bottom of this. So whether it was Johnson or whether it was Ford or whether it was Carter, as soon as they get into the White House, all three of them never mentioned the word UFO once they got in the White House. That's why I wrote the paper on the 64 reasons why they decided not to tell you the truth, because we have three guys who are determined before they become president that they are going to get to the bottom of this, they are going to disclose, they're going to get the information out to the American people, and they get into the White House and they suddenly do a 180-degree turn. They go exactly the opposite way. So when I was looking at the article, I said, what is it that they tell the president? What did they tell the president in his briefing that made him change teams? Why did he suddenly say, "Oh, I agree. I think we should cover it up. I wanted a disclosure, but now that I see what's going on, I want it covered up." And that's why I wrote the 64 reasons. And that was, what are they telling the president that makes Jimmy Carter, who was adamant he wanted this thing out, to change his mind?
Okay, so do you think it's a matter of they just change their mind, or are they told, "Look, you open your mouth on this thing and you're a dead person"?
Well, no, because, I mean, there may be some of that, but Jimmy Carter, people know who Jimmy Carter was. Jimmy Carter was an A-type personality. I mean, a lot of people will say to me, "Well, you know, if I was president, I would just fire people left, right, and center until I got to somebody who was going to tell me the truth." And Jimmy Carter was that type of guy. Jimmy Carter fired everybody, starting with George Bush, who was the CIA director, who was begging him to be kept on as CIA director. He fired him. He fired all sorts of people. I talked to people when I was at the Carter Library. I talked to a woman who at the time was the head of public affairs, public relations, for the Carter Library. She told me just horror stories about how scared they were of this guy, how he was, you know, the Baptist guy, and nobody was allowed to drink or smoke in front of him, and they would hide in the bar across the street in the back so that, you know, they wouldn't find, Jimmy Carter wouldn't find out that they were drinking and smoking and stuff like that. And they were just petrified of this guy. Jimmy Carter was a very tough guy, and Jimmy Carter would have got to the bottom. He would have fired a bunch of people to find out what was going on. I don't think he would have been scared off. And a lot of presidents are that way. I mean, they're very egocentric people. You got to be have a pretty heavy ego to get through a congressional and then through the presidential elections type stuff. These guys are pretty tough guys. And I don't think the scaring would really, because you'd see some actions that they would indirectly be doing things. But it's like a complete reversal. It's like not even to mention the word. I mean, except for like people like Ronald Reagan, who I think it was more like an Alzheimer type thing where he was just sort of talking about things that that he shouldn't have been talking about. For example, his national security advisor said that part of his job, this was Powell, what's his name, General... Yeah.
Colin Powell,
said that part of his job as National Security Advisor to President Reagan was to stop Reagan from talking about UFOs in public.
Really? Now, where'd you hear that?
Reagan was going to say, but the rest of them knew the whole thing. And as I said, like it's on my website. If you go to my website and you go to the article section and you look at the 64 reasons they've decided not to tell you the truth, I say absolutely that anybody who became president, whether it's you or me, if they came in and read you the briefing, you would change your mind as well. I think they're doing exactly what they think they have to do. For example, if you're president, I mean, you don't want to be the guy that's going to have this thing fall apart. I mean, you say, well, let the next president deal with this. I mean, you know, we should have it out, but I don't want it happening on my watch because you're going to be the guy who may be the guy who had the entire economy melt down on you and the whole thing go to hell. Yeah. And you're going to be the guy that gets the blame. Now, maybe 10 years from now, it's all going to work out okay and everything's going to be calmed down, but you're the guy that's going to be in the history books as the guy who came out and admitted that the government was lying, that, you know, people were killed, that cattle were being mutilated, that we don't have control of this. The president doesn't want to be in that situation. The president wants to be the smart guy. He wants to go down in history as, you know, the guy who solved the economy and was a nice guy. And, you know, you don't want to take the chance of being the guy who's going to release this thing and have it go south on you. So there are a lot of reasons. When you look, the 64 reasons, you look at the stuff, there's a lot of things that people don't think about. For example, I mean, I can give you piles of them. I mean, you say, well, we want free energy. This is what we want. We want free energy. Are you prepared to give free energy to China? Are you prepared to give free energy to India, where the rate of pay is like 50 cents an hour? Are you ready to give all the alien technology to Al-Qaeda? Are you ready to give it to North Korea? Once this thing starts coming out, then it starts to move around. Right now, it's a situation where we're in control. We have this kind of stuff. We can use it for military. We don't want to give it to anybody else. It's an economic advantage. It's a military advantage. We want to keep this to ourselves. And the whole idea about a war secret is that you have an advantage if you have military technology that's advanced over your enemy, because once you use it, the other guy is going to take like 70 years to build to develop the technology. So when you got it, the last thing you want to do is tell your enemy that you've got a secret. Mm. That's part of the advantage, is to keep it secret so that nobody knows you're working on it. You want the rest of the world to think this is a bunch of nonsense, that there is no mental phenomena where you can pick up people and abduct them and get into their mind and stuff like that. This kind of stuff is powerful, powerful technology that they don't want anybody else to have, and it's a tremendous advantage. You get this, you rule the world. It's as simple as that. And the Americans want to be the good guys. They want to be in control of this thing. They don't want to give it to the bad guys. They think if anybody should control this technology, we're the good guys. We're the guys that will use it for good. We need to control it, and we can't give it to anybody else.
All right. I need to take one more break to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, your host, and our guest today is Mr. Grant Cameron, a webmaster for presidentialufo.com. And what about Bill Clinton? He tried to get to the bottom of the UFO problem, too, unsuccessfully. What happened there?
Okay, Clinton was a guy who was very interested. A friend of mine, Paul Davids, who did the Roswell movie, talks about getting to Clinton and Hillary when Hillary's running for president, and he gives him the latest Roswell book, and he says Clinton looks down at it, and says, you know, I'm really fascinated in this kind of stuff, and I'm going to read this. So he was very interested. There was a rumored story that he and Hillary had a sighting, or somebody very close to them had a sighting at this famous barbecue restaurant in Hot Springs, Arkansas, where they all grew up. So he was very interested, and the story is, that's where a lot of the stories about the president not being in control come from, that he was approached by Lawrence Rockefeller, and he was trying to get the material out, and there's a couple of stories told. One is, it was told by Rockefeller after he went back from the talking with the Clintons at his ranch in August of 1995, and he said that basically the president was out of the loop. The president didn't know what was going on. The president was rumored to have said after that briefing when he got back to Washington, he says, I know there's something to this, but I can't get a thing. I'm being kept out of the loop. The other thing that happened is a senior White House reporter, Sarah McClendon, asked him the question, Mr. President, why don't you do what these UFO people are demanding? Why don't you do something about this? And according to her, he leaned over to her and said, Sarah, there's a government inside the government, and I don't control it. And that goes to this whole idea that there's this sort of secret group, and the president doesn't control the secret group. But I now think, I think there's at least a 50-50 chance that that's all put on, that the president is saying this kind of stuff, because the president wants to avoid the question. He doesn't want the Washington Post and New York Times coming to him and asking him a question. So this whole deal is put on like, you know, I'm really not responsible. The president has to be responsible. The president has to be in control of this thing. It doesn't make any sense that he's not. He's the head of state. So if you're dealing with a foreign power, if you're negotiating a treaty or an agreement with a foreign power, the president is the head of state. It has to be the president. You can't have a GS-13 negotiating with a foreign power, whether it's aliens or Chinese or Russians. It has to be the president. The president is the head of the intelligence agencies. He's the commander of the civilian commander of the U.S. military. He's the chief executive officer of the government. He is the top of all the pyramids in Washington. He has to be in charge. I think you would have piles and piles of defections if the president wasn't in charge. You'd have people going south. And because everybody believes the rules are being kept, and Dr. Walker told us at one point, he said, why should we change the rules to satisfy your curiosity? And I went, whoa, there's rules. He's actually confirming there are rules. They are playing by rules. If you look at Barack Obama is the most left-wing president that has ever come down the pike in the United States of America. And the rumored story inside the UFO community was always that the right-wing presidents, the Republicans, the pro-military guys, were told more than the Democrats, the guys like Carter, Clinton, who were anti-war and were considered to be pretty left-wing. So the story was always that the Republicans were told and the Democrats weren't told, which doesn't make any sense. But if you look at President Obama in the last year has made two statements that indicate quite clearly that he knows what's going on. And he's the most left-wing president. If he knows what's going on, then they all knew what was going on. And he made two statements. He makes one in Roswell, New Mexico. He goes to Roswell. He's campaigning last year for the election. He goes into Roswell. He's making a speech. And when you go to Roswell, as a president, you always got to make the joke. And that's how they protect themselves. They talk about UFOs, but it's a joke. And the press just, you know, it's a kind of funny joke. Nobody takes it seriously. And he says, at the beginning of his speech in Roswell last year, he says, I just want to let you know, the question that's asked to me most by 9- and 10-year-old boys in America is, Mr. President, what about Roswell? What's the deal? What is it true? And then Obama says, and I look at the little kids and I tell them, you know, if I told you, then I'd have to kill you. And he says, you can see the little kids, their eyes get all big and they're all scared. And, of course, the whole audience laughs. And this is a big joke. I mean, everybody laughed. Obama's told his joke. And then he hesitates. And then he says, we'll keep our secrets on this. So he knows. He's saying, and I'm pretty sure it wasn't in the speech. I've seen enough presidential speeches. It was at ad lib just before the speech starts. He says, we'll keep our secrets on this. So if he knows the story about Roswell, then he's the most left-wing president. Everybody has to know. The other thing that indicated that Obama knows what's going on, and it's a difficult situation, even him making jokes about it, because sooner or later someone's going to say, well, Mr. President, did you actually say this? Is it true? What's the deal? And the other one was Will Smith. Men in Black, the latest Men in Black movie came out last year. Will Smith gets an invitation to come to the White House, and he's going to go for a tour of the White House, and Jaden Smith, his son, who's, I think it was 13 at the time, or 14, is a real conspiracy guy. I mean, he's into every kind of conspiracy. He believes the UFOs, all the conspiracy stuff he's into. Mm-hmm. So he goes and he says to Will Smith, he says, I want to ask President Obama about the aliens. And Will says, no, we're not. You're not asking him about the aliens. You're not going to embarrass me in front of the president. He said, no, Dad, I want to ask him. He said, you are not going to ask the president about the aliens. They go to the White House. They're on the tour. They get to the Situation Room, which is the key room where they, you know, where everybody sat when they knocked off Bin Laden.
Right.
It is the center of power in the White House. Is the Situation Room. They're in the Situation Room during the tour, and Will Smith says, Jaden looks over at him and says, Dad, what's my punishment? And he says, No, don't ask him. And President Obama says, without any prompting as to what the question is going to be, he says, Jaden, I know what you want to ask about. You want to know about the aliens. And Jaden says, yeah, I want to know about the aliens. And President Obama says, I can neither confirm nor deny that extraterrestrials have visited the Earth. But if they did, and if there had been a top-secret meeting, it would have occurred in this very room. And Jaden goes, yeah, I knew it. And he's all excited, whatever. Now, Obama's taken a big chance, because if the Washington Post or New York Times, if they hadn't been bought out or whatever is going on there, somebody comes up and says, well, what did you actually say to Jaden? Is this true? I mean, and you start this sort of slide. So the fact that Obama is making these kind of statements indicates to me that the president does know. There's a good chance. I mean, maybe he doesn't, but I think there's a good chance that basically it's what's called a USAP, an unacknowledged special access program. And that means you cannot acknowledge the program. You cannot say anything about it. You're allowed to lie about it. Nobody is to know that there's even a program. So the president is in the same situation, the same as you and I. They can throw him in jail the same as you and I can be thrown in jail for leaking classified material. Mm. When he gets the presidential briefing, they sit down. The first thing they do is, Mr. President, this is a top secret briefing with whatever codes. Here's the paper. He signs for the briefing. He says, here's the briefing. I'm going to keep it secret. Once they give him the briefing, he's sworn to secrecy. He can't talk. And if it's unacknowledged, he's not allowed to acknowledge the program exists. Mm. And there's no doubt that if UFOs are real, if ETs are here, if there's technology, it is an unacknowledged special access program, and the president is in the same box as everybody else, so they play this little game that nobody knows what's going on, we really haven't got anywhere, you know, it's just swamp gas, and the government doesn't know anything and stuff like that, and everybody plays along the game, and they keep continuing to work on the technology.
Well, Dick Cheney said something similar, wasn't it, to you on the radio?
Yeah, that was my thing. And I think I caught him off guard, because he had never been asked. I'm pretty sure he'd never been asked the question. He appeared on a radio talk show in Washington, D.C., the Diana Rehm show, the public radio thing there. And I knew he was going to be on. I knew how to get on the radio talk show. Mm-hmm. And he was rumored to be one of the MJ-12 guys. One of the guys who was on MJ-12, he was one of the most powerful people. In fact, when he was being interviewed by Diana Rehm, she actually asked him before I asked the question, she said, is it true that you're the prime minister? Are you running the show? Because there was this rumored story that Bush was sort of like a monkey guy, and it was actually Dick Cheney who was running the show, and Bush was just doing what he's told. Mm-hmm. So he said, no, I'm not running the White House. No. And so what happened was, I knew how to get on the show. I was first person up, and that's when I asked him the question. He had been chief of staff for Ford. He had been secretary of defense under Bush Sr., and now he was the vice president. And I said to him, Mr. Cheney, I want to know about the briefing, which is critical, I always say, if your listeners are listening, if you get a high-level four-star general or a vice president or a president, the question you want to ask him is not what do you think about UFOs? Did you have a UFO sighting? Don't waste your time. The question you want to ask is, did you ever get briefed? And that's the whole thing about the truth. Did anybody ever walk into your office, swear you to secrecy, and give you a briefing on UFOs? That's the secret. That's the truth that's told, is the briefing. Mm. So I said to him, Mr. Cheney, in all your jobs in government, have you ever been briefed on the subject of UFOs? If so, when was it, and what were you told? And he sort of hesitated, and he said, if I had been briefed on that subject, it would probably be classified, and I wouldn't be talking about it. And I was shocked that he said that, because he basically confirmed, this is classified, and I'm not talking about it. It's the basic, it's the unacknowledged special access program. I'm not talking about it. And then Diana Rehm came back with another question, and he sort of got his footing. He suddenly realized we were talking about UFOs, and she said, have there been any meetings since you got to the White House? And he said, no, there have been no UFO meetings since I got to the White House. Mm. And then she went on to another subject. So that's basically what happened with Cheney, but I think he slipped. He should not have said that, because it basically confirmed, yes, this is classified. This is for real.
Oh, yeah? Or the answer would have been, ha-ha, no, of course not.
Yeah, and that's what they do if they know the question's coming. We did actually catch another guy we caught off guard, and that was General Wesley Clark, who was a four-star general, who was head of Allied forces in Europe. Mm. And that is the level. A four-star general with a unified command gets the briefing. And that was the rumored story. So when he was running for president in 2004 against Hillary Clinton, he's very good friends with the Clintons, I was trying to get people in the United States to go to his, because they had the open houses, you know, before they actually get the nomination, and then they suddenly shut up and nobody talks anymore. When they're doing the open houses, they take actual questions. And I said, somebody's going to ask General Wesley Clark the rumor, because somebody had contacted me, an intelligence person contacted me and said he's been briefed on cross-flying saucers. So I tried, and nobody would ask the question. And nobody, I was even going to go out, I live in Canada, I was going to go down to Iowa, Massaf, and ask him the question, to ask this briefing question, have you ever been briefed? Finally, at the very end of the campaign, he leaves the campaign, and he's campaigning for Kerry. This is in 2004, this is in November. Just a couple days before the election, he's going to New Mexico. In New Mexico, everybody ends up in New Mexico at the end of the election, except this last election, because New Mexico always used to be a swing state, and it's only got 5 electoral votes, but it's always a swing state. It can go either way. So everybody goes to New Mexico at the very end of the campaign trying to get those 5 electoral votes. Mm-hmm. So he's heading there. He's in Nevada trying to get Nevada. He's in Reno, Nevada, lecturing there, campaigning, and he's heading for Roswell the next day. A friend of mine, Dr. David Rudiak from Berkeley, actually turns him down the first time. He turns me down the first time when he's in California. He doesn't ask him a question. Then he's there, and he sees that Clark is lecturing, and he says, well, I might as well ask him a question. So he goes in, and he says to him, General Clark, Clark had made a statement early in the campaign when he was in New Hampshire. He'd made a statement talking about the fact that he wanted to be an astronaut because his eyesight wasn't very good. He had gone into the Army, and he worked his way up and become a four-star general. But he actually wanted to be an astronaut. He was interested in space, and he said, I believe we can go past the speed of light. I believe we can do it. I've argued with physicists, and they don't agree, but I believe we can do it. And I'm thinking, what the heck is a four-star general saying he believes we can go past the speed of light? So that's what the question was. He said, Mr. General Clark, in the campaign, you said that you believe that we could go past the speed of light, and you made this statement. My question to you, General, is, have you ever been briefed on the subject of UFOs? And he hesitates, he looks down at the floor, and he looks up and he says, I know a bit. In fact, I'm going to Roswell tonight. And then David Rudiak doesn't fall for it. He goes back, so you have been briefed. And he said, we haven't got there, we have to work on our mathematics. And that was an important thing, was that they were having problems with the mathematics, which was something that the head of Lockheed Skunk Works talked about, Ben Rich. In 1993, right. Ben Rich talked about the fact that they now had the technology to take E.T. home. And a lot of people have talked about this thing about mathematics. And Ben Rich says, we found the mistake in the equation. We now know how to take E.T. home, and it's not going to take a lifetime to do. And so Clark is talking about this fact that we have to work on the mathematics. So we've got a problem with the mathematics. But at that point, they leave it, and he wanders off, and the thing ends. So we have two very high-level guys who basically confirm, yes, this is for real. They don't make the joke. They don't laugh. They don't say, you know, it's a good thing, but I really don't believe in it. Mm. They both fall for it because they're caught off guard. So that's why I say to people, if you get a four-star general or if you get a high-level government official, the question you want to ask them is, did you ever get a briefing on this subject?
Well, you just never know. You can take a educated guess, but you don't know. Who knows what? Who's in the loop, you know?
Yeah, well, there are rumors. I mean, for example, I can tell you another story, a very interesting story. I talked about it a bit at the Disclosure Citizens Hearing in Washington. Mm-hmm. It was part of my testimony. And this is a story that in 1989, if you know the story about Area 51, the story breaks. Bob Lazar going on the base, claiming he's on the base. This is KLS TV in Las Vegas, breaks the story. It goes viral around the world. Everybody's all over this story. And the story is that in the Senate, Senator Byrd, who is the head of the Appropriations Committee in the U.S. Senate, is listening to these stories about, we got live, what the heck is this? We got alien spacecraft, live alien at Area 51. And, of course, they start to question. And Byrd is running the Appropriations Committee. The Appropriations Committee is extremely important because they are the ones that appropriate the money inside the U.S. government for everything. They're the guys that hand out the money. Right. So this is one of the most powerful committee in the Senate. So Byrd is having a meeting with his some of the senators on the committee, and they're saying, what the heck's going on here? Do we have alien technology at Area 51? And they said, if they do, we haven't appropriated the money for flying saucer research. So what they do is they send a guy by the name of Dick D'Amato. And Dick D'Amato is a lawyer. He's with the National Security Council. And this story I've heard, and this is a legitimate story, they take him, and he's a legal advisor to the Appropriations Committee. And they say, we need you to go. We need you to get to the bottom of this thing. We need you to go to Area 51, and we need to find out, are we spending money on flying saucers? So Dick D'Amato tells a story. He goes to Area 51, and he tries to get in there. And
89.3 Making Waves. This is WHFR Dearborn, streaming audio at WHFR.FM.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily.
We need you to get to the bottom of this thing. We need you to go to Area 51, and we need to find out, are we spending money on flying saucers? So Dick D'Amato tells a story. He goes to Area 51, and he tries to get in there, and he talks to a guy by the name of, no, his name's going to escape me. His name escapes me. He's one of the top three people at EG&G, which is the major contractor there. Mm-hmm. And this guy has been telling stories that Alfred O'Donnell is the guy's name. So Alfred O'Donnell has been telling stories behind the scenes that it's all for real, that they had the live alien, they didn't know what to do with the live alien, they were afraid it was going to escape from Area 51, that they had the back engineering saucers. He's telling these stories. So Dick D'Amato goes to this guy and he says, I need you to talk. I can give you immunity. I've got all this power from the Senate Appropriations Committee, from NSC and stuff. And the guy says, no, I can't talk. You got to talk to my boss. I'm not allowed to talk. Goes to talk to the guy's boss. His boss says, I don't give a care. He can talk. I wasn't involved in this. He can talk. He goes back, and the guy won't talk. So Dick D'Amato comes back, and he makes a number of statements to a number of people. And the one statement he made was to Stephen Greer. He said, I want to let you know, I've been working on this. I've got every clearance, all the power of the U.S. government behind me, and I tried to get to the bottom of this thing, and I couldn't get to the bottom of this thing. I just want to let you know, Stephen Greer, you're up against the varsity team of all black budget programs. Take care, be careful, and good luck. And then he tells, the story is told, and I was going to bring in my testimony at the citizens' hearing, but Jesse Marcel did it, because I contacted Jesse Marcel, and I said, I'd like to hear this story. I heard this rumored story about what he had been told, and I said, can you tell me the story? But Jesse didn't respond to me, but then he tells the story. He goes on to the committee, and he tells the story. And the story he tells is the Dick D'Amato story. He's contacted, the same as Stephen Grace, contacted by Dick D'Amato. Dick D'Amato says, I want to talk to you in Washington. So he comes along, and he says, you know, he's talking to him, and Jesse Marcel Jr. says, well, I've told everything I know about, you know, seeing the medal and stuff. There's really nothing I can tell you more about Roswell, my involvement with Roswell. And Dick D'Amato says, no, I want to tell you something. Let's go to the and he goes to the sub basement of the U.S. Capitol to a secure room, and he goes into the room with Dick D'Amato. This is a secure room, and he sits him down at a table, and a big, huge boardroom table. And on the desk is a book called Majestic. It was written by Whitley Strieber, right. And it's a book that talks about the Roswell, and it also talks about MJ-12, the fact that there's this control group. And he says, I just want to let you know that this is all for true. He puts his hand on the book. He says, I just want to let you know, it's for real. I tried to get to the bottom of this. I couldn't get to the bottom of this. And so Jesse says to him, well, why won't they release this? And he said, well, if it was up to me, I would release it today. But it's not up to me. There are people running this thing who are not elected, who have unlimited power and unlimited money. And I just wanted to let you know that it's for real. So Dick D'Amato, who's still running around, he's around, he's not in government anymore, but here's a guy who spent a lot of time in the late 1980s and early 1990s trying to get to the bottom of this thing and basically confirmed this thing's for real. They had the alien stuff at Area 51. It's all got to do with weapons, and there's a lot of money and no real accountability for what they're doing.
All right. Mr. Grant Cameron, once again, give us your website where we can check you out.
Yeah, it's presidentialufo.com.
That's it, presidentialufo.com. And you're coming out with this 64, what is it, 64?
Well, I'm coming out on a book called Alien Invasion, and it's the story of the flaps along the Canadian-U.S. border in 1975, 1976 that got me started. So that book should be out shortly, and then there's another book but that's coming in the spring. So.
And you can't tell us about that.
I can tell you about it. It's going to be called The Alien Bedtime Storybook, because what happened with me is I would tell stories. My book that I just released was called UFOs, Area 51 and Government Informants, but it's a very technical type book where it's got a lot of footnotes and stuff like that, and a lot of people sort of complained to me that it was a very interesting book, but it was very detailed. It's hard to read. Because it's like a historical book. So I figured, well, people really want to hear stories. That's all they really want to hear. So what this book, this Alien Bedtime Storybook, is going to be is a lot of stories that I've heard over the years. So okay. You can just read a story. It's 5-6 pages before you go to bed. And it's going to be like maybe 100 different stories.
Okay. Mr. Grant Cameron, thank you so much for joining us. I hope we can do it
thank
again.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. Now, this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage, and then Tuesday Forum. And then, of course, the date of the show. And We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is ufoimplications.com. So please stay tuned to whfr.fm. The only station making waves for the best in alternative programming. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. Until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
WHFR Dearborn. WHFR, the station making waves, proudly presents The Best of Broadway, a program featuring the best of American musical theater. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Joe, your host. We've taken care of your tickets. Now let me escort you through 2 hours of enjoyment of The Best of Broadway. Welcome once again to The Best of Broadway. I'm Joe, your host, and today our play is going to be How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying.